another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and this week's episode is entitled Heroes of the Past. Heroes of the past, who are they? What do we mean by that phrase? Well, I just saw Scorsese's new, very much highly anticipated film, Killers of the Flower Moon. And while I was watching the film, I had some thoughts that were very reminiscent of the thoughts I had in some recent travels through the Balkans, actually, particularly in Sarajevo in Bosnia, which was the location of many a dispute over the years. It was the ground zero of World War One with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, and then there was obviously the Siege of Sarajevo not that long ago. And I had some thoughts whilst driving around there, like, how does this place keep having problems, and how does it have, like, serious problems of genocide and ethnic cleansing and things like that well into the 20th century, like up to the back end of, like, the 1990s. Like, you know, the internet was around when that was happening. And when I was having those thoughts, it was eerily similar to, like, a lot of the stuff that's also happening in other parts of the world right now, and even in our own country, in Australia, questions around, you know, I guess the main question we're talking about is around past wrongs, you know, even if they're fairly recent past wrongs or sometimes very long ago, and the impact they have onto the future, and how we should view past wrongs and how we should view the perpetrators of those past wrongs and where their place in the future and where their place in the present is, and how should we view them, and does our view of them change, and is that a good thing, is that a bad thing? Those are the kind of questions we're going to be asking this week. And I think all through today's episode, I think it's important to, like, we've talked about this topic a couple of times. We've talked about things like false prophets and dark knights and masked heroes and going under the radar and doing the right thing even though everyone thinks it's the wrong thing. But there's a phrase I really want to touch on that I think underpins a lot of these issues that are going to be pinging in the films we're talking about, is that phrase from The Dark Knight, which we won't be talking about, but I don't think I ever understood it until this week, but you either die the hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. I think it's just I invite people just to think about that phrase throughout today's episode. I think it very much is at the core of what we're talking about. The films we're going to be chatting about, though, specifically, are Kills of the Flower Moon, directed by Martin Scorsese. We're then going to move on to Akira from 1988, directed by Katsuhiro Otomo. And then we're going to finish off with the 1962 version of The Manchurian Candidate, directed by John Frankenheimer. But let's get things started with Killers of the Flower Moon. Now, if you haven't seen this one, I can forgive you if you haven't, because it's only just come out, but it's about what happened to the people of the Osage County at their kind of around the turn of the century, or straight after the First World War, when there's a lot of oil money there, and it kind of happened to pass into the hands of a lot of sort of white folks coming through, and there was a series of murders that took place then. And I think the two big questions that I sort of asked myself while I was watching this film is, how did all this calamity get ushered in, kind of like on an objective level? Like if you were a scientist, how would you actually explain the series of events that had had to take place that resulted in what happened? But also, how was this calamity justified by the perpetrators? And I think you can actually kind of answer both of those questions with the same answer. And it's kind of an answer that we give a lot on this show when we talk about things like false prophets and snake oil salesmen and that sort of thing, is that you can justify almost anything, and you can see the world usher in all kinds of evil when those perpetrators or those future perpetrators present themselves as good people through acts of good faith, which kind of establish them as a person that we can all trust, and in their own hearts can establish them as a person of good character that can trust in themselves to do the right thing in the long term. There's a lot of ways that the film does this, particularly the character of Robert De Niro's character is the main one that we're talking about here. His name's William Hale, who's like the big rich guy in the area that's kind of the puppeteer of all this stuff. And I can't help but think that there was sort of almost like a Trumpian aspect to the way he spoke, especially near the end of the film. And I'd be interested to know if other people agree with that and how you felt about it. And I think sort of whether that was a good choice or a bad choice, I think will be revealed a bit further in today's episode when we talk about some of the other films. But there's a lot of dialogue where he sort of talks about how, you know, he opens up schools and hospitals and things like that, and he sort of comes across as this great guy and sort of helps justify for the people around him and himself that what he's doing, even though he's doing egregious acts of murder, are actually good things. And it's very reminiscent of anyone that you know, when they try and justify themselves, like whether it's Charles Manson or some crazy politician, it's always the same thing. You sort of rely on some good thing that they did in the past or some interpretation of history that shows that they're actually a good person, right? We've talked about this a lot of times on the show. Evil people don't call themselves evil. It doesn't help their cause to accept they're evil. They're going to further their cause and fly under the radar better if they present themselves as good people. So it's done pretty literally through his character. But at this point in the conversation, I actually want to talk more about Leonardo DiCaprio's character, who is this kind of lackey. He's the one that actually gets his hands dirty doing all this stuff. And I think even though it was obviously, it's a historic film, this wasn't an intentional metaphor, but I think there's an aspect of the story that serves as a really important metaphor, which is that he's an ex-veteran. And he's an ex-veteran World War One, and I think he was a chef or whatever, so it's not really that big a deal. But it means that there's a real archetype here of ex-veterans returning home and maybe having this expectation, or society having an expectation that they're going to be looked after and sympathized with, and we're going to be very hospitable for everything they need and understanding of sort of why they're a bit mad and crazy. But it obviously leaves the rest of us to have a bit of a difficult time, maybe, given their implications. It's a bit of an archetype, right? It's another Scorsese film that explores this, which is Taxi Driver. I couldn't help think of the film, Paul Thomas Anderson's film, The Master, throughout this film. I couldn't help but see a lot of similarities between DiCaprio's character and Joaquin Phoenix's character in that film. We've got this ex-veteran that comes back kind of pretty disillusioned, disoriented with, you know, what's up and what's down. You can imagine like Martin Sheen's character coming back from Apocalypse Now, kind of going, well, I don't really know which way to go. And he's got the U.S. Army uniform on at the beginning. So we have this, and this is going to be some running imagery throughout all three of today's films. But there's a particular act that he does that I think is really, really profound, which is that he's the one that gives his wife, who's sort of she becomes sort of the matriarch of the Osage group by the end of the film in a way. He keeps giving her insulin because she has diabetes. And medicine is very often in the culture used as kind of like the good aspect of colonialism. It's like, you know, we brought technology and medicine. Would you rather go back to the way, the way things were in sort of a primitive and traditional state without things like insulin and stuff like that? But I won't give it too much away, but it's actually the giving of the medicine that makes her more sick and hinders the health. So I think it's a really interesting flip of the script there from Scorsese in sort of emphasizing this aspect of the story where the classic symbol of benevolent colonialism, which is like an act of, giving medicine, ailing, helping someone, aiding someone who's ailing, like this is typically a good thing, traditionally a good thing. That's actually the very thing that hurts her. And so we sort of see how an act of goodness can actually be an act of hindrance, right? But in all its revisionism, right, with this film, it sort of gives us a strong sense of who the bad guys and who the good guys were, and that we can understand that. That's reasonable. But I can't help but have this thought that it falls on its own sword in doing this in a way, in an unavoidable way, might I say, which is that doesn't the film sort of imply the same idea we've sort of said over and over again on this show, which is that villains are strongest when they don't pronounce their villainous ways? And the film is definitely right about this, right? Otherwise, villains would never emerge again. We would know them when we see them. But they do keep coming back, right? We know villains exist in the world today. So, like, we can spot the villains in this revisionist story. We know the villains are there. If we're so good at picking a villain, are we only able to do it through hindsight? And why only through hindsight? Shouldn't an act, in isolation be indicative of whether a person is a good or a bad person? Why do they keep coming back? How come we can't tell when a villain is a villain, and when do they stop becoming a villain, and how can we know the difference between a genuine good act and an act that's used as a sort of a Trojan horse kind of thing? And this is where the conversation today is going to get a lot more confusing and convoluted and hypocritical, let's say. But before we move on, just a reminder that you are listening to 2XX98.3 FM People Powered Radio. I am your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, and please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. Or consider jumping onto our website to listen there or sponsoring or supporting us by subscribing. All that would be very much because you'd be a hero today and a hero tomorrow if you were able to do all that for us. But moving on now to Katsuhiro Otomo's 1988 film Akira, I want to talk about this one, about how it sort of conveys how calamity has this kind of reoccurring nature. So we were talking before about you know, if we look at history through sort of through a revisionist lens, we can always tell who the good guys and the bad guys were. But if bad things keep happening, we got to sort of ask, well, how is it that bad guys keep coming up if we all know what a bad guy is when we look at it in hindsight? Well, this film starts off with this enormous explosion, right? World War III has happened in, I think it was 1988 in this film. And so we're kind of wondering, well, what caused that? And then that image is immediately juxtaposed with this kind of wondrous cyberpunk cityscape, which is kind of what the film is known for a lot of people, how it's got this very alluring kind of gigantic cityscape that just really, especially because the film is animated, it's just great to look at all the colors and the way that the light is used, and it's buildings behind buildings. It sort of like makes you, it reminded me of like when I was a kid, you used to watch a film like Space Jam, and I always wanted to do an episode of Sacred Cinema on films that had that kind of like open sense of wonder, that there's new worlds behind other worlds, and it feels like the world is something that's yet to be explored, and it's something we want more. This can't be, you know, this isn't enough. We like the idea of finding new places. So there is a sort of sense of wonder about this giant cityscape, although it's riddled with problems, which we'll get into in a second. And I think it's at this point, so immediately, despite being so immediately after this giant explosion, that the film lulls us into one of the greatest false senses of security in the history of cinema, in my view, at least upon first watch of this film. So we get this sense of security from this very robust, insurmountable cityscape. We also have the military man figure who's kind of running the show, because I don't want to go into it, I haven't seen the film, but there's these escaped science children that they need to find, and this big military guy is in the way, but he's this big, broad-shouldered guy, and he's not like a perfect man, but he's kind of got like that benevolent father attitude about him, which is like, we know he's a bit rough around the edges and a bit aggressive, but he looks like a kind of guy that would steer you clear of the storm in stormy seas kind of thing. But he also, you know, in his robustness, gives us this explanation of how Akira, who was the cause of that big bomb at the very start, is gone. And then we actually see where he's hidden, and he as a humanoid figure doesn't actually exist anymore. And I remember the first time I watched this film, I was like, well, what's this film going to be about? Like, if he's gone and it's the name of the film, what's going to happen from now? Is nothing going to happen? What's the deal with this? And then we even get clues sort of scattered through the film. As I mentioned before, there's these lingering socioeconomic issues happening in this neo-Tokyo cityscape. And again, we had a first shot for a reason of that. We had that first shot of the atomic bomb at the beginning for a reason, right? There's obviously something massive that happened, but we can't help but feel like, you know, and it's just very reminiscent of life, right? Like, I remember 10 years ago thinking that the idea of a World War III was just so alien. And this is very World War III in reality. In the film, I guess World War III has already happened, so World War IV is what they are not worried about. But I remember like 10 years ago just like thinking that World War III is just so impossible. Geopolitical crises could never spill into a major war. And now we're seeing the Russian government performing nuclear strike rehearsals. We're seeing the same thing, obviously, in North Korea for quite some time. But it's starting to get to a point where we start to feel like, if World War III happened tomorrow, it wouldn't feel that weird. If someone asks you, hey, did you see it coming? You're like, well, kind of, like more than 0% chance. And more than 0% chance is a concern. But going back to the film, you're at this point where you're seeing problems everywhere, but you don't really feel like anything bad's about to happen, or you don't know what bad things could happen, is probably a better way to put it. You know, there are crazy people in this world. You don't know how they're going to go about doing a terrible thing, how a terrible thing like what we saw at the very start of the film, it could happen again. But then, of course, there's an actual false sense of security, because at the end of the film, you know, we see what happens, and I won't give it away if you haven't seen the film. And this leads us to kind of the next important point that I think needs to be made about a film like Akira. Because while a film like Killers of the Flower Moon warns us against like false prophets, like be scared of, you know, worry about the people that are sort of doing these good acts to Trojan horse their power, you know, through the gates, Akira sort of flips that on its head. It kind of subverts that a little bit, where Akira, the character, like the actual boy, and Akira is a boy, by the way, if you haven't seen the film. That's what in Japanese, by the way, Akira means like big bright light or something like that. But the actual character of Akira, when he shows up in the film, is, even though we know he's the source of great calamity at the beginning of the film, he was the source of the great calamity at the beginning of the film, he isn't depicted that way when we see him. I think that's really important. Because that's kind of what happens when we talked about how, you know, a villain can usher themselves in as a good guy. a past villain can kind of look heroic in a certain light, in a certain context, and suddenly we start feeling a sense of support, or feeling that a past villain actually could be useful, something that our society could use. And so in the film, he's kind of got this angelic quality to him. He's quite sort of pure and white. And when he exercises his power, it's all very peaceful and quiet. And I think more importantly, you know, the characters use him as a means to destroy the next Akira, right? Who is this character, Tetsuo, who's kind of gaining all this power throughout the film. And understandably, this film, it kind of is very reminiscent of past episodes we've done on Cold War and Cold War films, where the ends justify, well, we have this question around whether the ends are justifying the means and the means are justifying the ends, blah, 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 where using the very thing you are trying to avoid in these films you see characters using the very thing they are trying to avoid the thing they're trying to avoid, if that makes sense. Like, and you see this in a lot of Cold War films. Spyro Camp of the Cold is a classic one. And what it does is it induces this kind of cyclical nature of calamity, where we have this kind of tragic twist to think that we've just, when we get to the end of this film, we feel like we've just watched not only like what just happened, but that's what happened before this film started, right? When we saw that big bomb, everything that happened before that was actually what we just watched as well, or, you know, mirrored that or paralleled that. And everything that's going to take place after this film finishes is everything that we just watched as well, right? We have means justifying ends, justifying means, justifying ends. And we have this cycle where, well, it's not just that villains are being ushered in because they come across as good guys, but villains of the past are now the heroes of the present, because only they're the only things that it can avoid enacting the very same problems that we tried to avoid, ironically, by making them the villains, or the very things that made them villains, I should say. So if you're confused at this point, you're meant to be, right? If this sounds like a whole bunch of hypocrisies, that's the ideological world we live in, where we accept a state of reality and we ignore every other reality that also exists, right? We accept that something's good and something else is bad, but then when the context changes and the things that were actually bad in this new that are actually bad in the new context were good in the past and vice versa, we are confused and we're in a muddle. You're meant to feel like you're in a muddle at this point, because the world is in a muddle. And I think that in the internet age, and this thing we'll probably touch on a little bit more in our next film, there's so many lenses through which to interpret the world. It's so hard to know who the good and the bad guys are. You can be forgiven for that. How could one possibly know who the good and the bad guys are in any given moment in the present world? So how do we generally find our bearings? Not how should we, but how do we find our bearings in this convoluted mess? And how can we do that in a way that still maintains this healthy sense of cynicism towards false prophets as evoked in Kills of the Flower Moon? Well, let's move on to our third and final film today. And that's The Manchurian Candidate, the 1962 version, not the Denzel Washington one, directed by John Frankenheimer. And the plot of this one is that you've got this ex-veteran, again, another ex-army person, played by Lawrence Harvey. The name of the character is Raymond Shaw. And we see the very first scene of the film, he wasn't respected by his troops. But then they're all hypnotized, which is obviously very metaphorical, you know, conditioning, hegemony, that sort of thing. By these communists that captured them. And when they come back to us, America, they all promote and respect this Raymond Shaw character. They all say, oh, he's one of the best guys I ever served under. And he then goes on to do some very, very bad things and then ultimately does the right thing. But then the world itself probably thinks what he did is actually a bad thing, but we all know it was actually the right thing, right? So I want to talk about how the film sort of achieves the same things the two films we've talked about already achieves the same things that they achieve, but also probably goes a step further in my view. So this idea of the false prophet, Shaw is clearly this revolving door kind of character, right? At the start of the film, he's a bad guy, then he's a good guy, then he's a bad guy, then he's a good guy. And he's wearing the medals on his shirt, and he's depicted, he has a Medal of Honor. That's the big thing about his character at the start. He gets given this Medal of Honor thing. So we're all expected to think, you know, the world, I should say, not the audience, but the world, you know, is expected to think that he's a hero. He's just come back from war. He's a hero. But we know that he's been hypnotized to do bad things. So again, we have this kind of false prophet, kind of false hero, masked villain aspect to this character. And then I think also it's important to note as well that I think we'll touch on a bit further, but the politicization of everything, using a war story, using a war hero in the media, or at least in, because Lawrence Harvey's mother, played by Angela Lansbury, who's a key character in this film, her new husband, his stepfather, is running for office as a conservative candidate for the presidency of the United States, and he kind of uses his relationship with Lawrence Harvey as like an indicator that he's a real true blue American. So again, we have this idea of like, I'm a go-go American, you know, I'm a classic capital A American. So, you know, supporters would think he's a normal guy, he's a great guy. But we know, you know, as the audience members, we know that he's actually not so much a great guy. But the film also, as you could have probably already told, it also creates that sense of, you know, having that sort of false prophet element to it as well. It does create that sense of hypocrisy and confusion and a convoluted state of reality where, you know, we can't put Lawrence Harvey's character in a category of good or bad, because he keeps going in and out of whether he's doing the right or wrong thing. And we know that in his heart at the beginning, he actually wasn't a very nice guy. And he's yet to actually prove himself as a nice guy, even though he's a victim of the system. So it's very hard to place him. But then on a political level as well, this whole thing, as what you find out, was a conspiracy at the hands of his mother, who is a conservative, who has sided with the communists, who famously conservatives don't like, to then gain power, to then use that power to fight against the communists. And if that isn't reminiscent of how 20th century geopolitics went out, you know, with the alliances between America and the Soviet Union in the Second World War, which were then flipped in the Cold War, you have China supporting the North Vietnamese and then going into Cambodia and then fighting back against them a few years later. It is as constant as war itself that allies become enemies at the next conflict and vice versa, and switching and changing. Look at Germany now being a key NATO force, despite the fact that NATO existed in a world where we were fearful of the Soviet Union, who was fearful of the West because of Germany, because of Nazis. Where are the Nazis today? All of these questions become convoluted on the political level as much as they become convoluted on the personal level as to who is a good and a bad guy, right? There's a parallel story happening. Every individual that we've seen on these movies that switches between good and bad is a microcosm of the state itself, which switches between being the side of good and the side of bad. You might hate your country, but it was a good country at one point, and it was a bad country at another point. It just depends on where you're standing. So we have these clashing ideas in the film. So where do the characters find their bearings in this film, and is it concerning, and how do they fight against, you know, where they found themselves? Well, the rub of all this is that I think it's really important that the key bad guy in this film is Angela Lansbury. We know that she's sort of the head puppeteer, and it's not insignificant that she, I mean, it is significant that she's Lawrence Harvey's mother. Right, that there's a metaphorical value to that. When we think about a mother and a son, there's an unconditional trust toward the maternal from the child, right? And as I mentioned before, I think that her as an individual is reminiscent of broader entities that we feel an unconditional sense of trust towards. I don't know who that is or what that is for you, dear listener. Maybe it's the state, maybe it's your company that you work for, maybe it's literally your own parents, but we all have something or someone that we feel a sense of unconditional trust towards. I can't help but think that this film sort of promotes a kind of healthy kind of cynicism towards those that we've grown to trust unconditionally. If you haven't seen the film, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I think that's best depicted in the final scene of this film, where what happens is what we want to happen, and it is the right thing for this character to do, despite the fact that it goes against kind of everything that might feel natural to somebody else. But let's kind of tie everything together this way, right? We've talked about a lot, speaking of being convoluted, right? So when we talk about Kills of the Flower Moon, we talk about how villains can very easily be ushered in, both by their victims, their future victims, but also through their own moral assessments of themselves, through acts of good faith. And we saw the metaphor of the medicine, which is traditionally seen as a good thing that colonialists brought in. But it's, I think the subversion of that metaphor is really clever in that film, to sort of talk about how even the things that look like good things can actually be the bad things, that they're the things that actually undermine the more fundamental good things about out of society can be the things that, on a superficial level, look like good things in the immediate sense. And this has horrific implications, because what it actually ultimately does is imply this sort of cyclical reoccurrence of calamity. And in Akira, we talk about the idea that villains of the past can sometimes be employed to avoid the very same acts they will have to perform in order to avoid someone else performing those very same acts, right? Ending in this cycle of busting and booming and busting and booming. And I don't mean to make a joke about economics there, because we're talking mostly about cultural busting and booming. And I don't think there's a shortage of examples in the current world where we see a past villain used as much as we see present villains sort of showing themselves as good guys to create future problems. We also see past villains being used as to somehow be present good guys. I mean, it's even in that film, The Suicide Squad, is very much about that idea of, you know, there's so many examples. I mean, what happened at the Canadian Parliament a couple of weeks ago is probably another example of that. But there's no shortage of examples of countries and individuals throughout the 20th century making alliances with their enemies of the past and vice versa. And it leads us to this convoluted ideological war where there is no single reality that we can rely on for what is a good and what is a bad person, or what is a good or what is a bad act. Yet in this world of confusion, we somehow find moral bearings. And the way that we do that is generally to trust in those that we've grown to habitually trust unconditionally. The maternal, right? Things that we've grown to see as kind of gods amongst men, entities or people that somehow have a higher status in our minds of being moral arbiters, being people that seem to have some kind of insight or foresight into morality that no one else has. And for some reason, we trust their word more than anyone else. But I think what these films kind of remind us of is that no one person can be so omnipotent, so intelligent to know what is a good or a bad person in any given situation. It's much too complicated for the human mind. And the rub of that, the implication of that, is that we probably do need a dose of a healthy kind of cynicism, and that we really need to sort of exercise a great deal of might and fight against some pretty habitual urges in order to do that. It's not something that should be easy. It shouldn't be something as simply flipping off the government saying, "Oh, I hate that, you know, they claim to be good." It's generally people that we really do unconditionally trust that we have to fight against to a healthy extent, I should say. We shouldn't enact sort of private wars. But you have to think very hard about who is that Angela Lansbury character in our own lives, because there is a lot at stake these days, right? This is a cycle that is as old as people and as old as land disputes and as old as territory disputes. It's an old, ancient problem in the human condition. And if this cycle continues on its current trajectory, i.e. something like a nuclear war, the only way that we'll be able to kill it, the only way we'll be able to kill this cycle, is for us to kill ourselves, leaving us to be nothing more than mere heroes of the past. Well, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. Be sure to stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. And also consider jumping onto our website if you're not listening there already to subscribe to the station or sponsor the show. You'd be a real hero in my eyes if you do either of those things. But until next week, thank you so much for tuning in, and have a good week. Cheers.